lips to lips. The violins were still weeping, performing, it seemed, a hymn of passion and love, but already Irina and the deeply moved Dolinin were rapidly walking toward the exit. They were lured by the spring night, by the mystery that had tensely stood up between them. Their two hearts were beating as one. "Give me your cloakroom ticket," uttered Dolinin. Crossed out. "Please, let me get your hat and manteau." Crossed out. "Please," uttered Dolinin, "let me get your things. And my," inserted between "your" and "things." Dolinin went up to the cloakroom, and after producing his little ticket, corrected to "both little tickets." Here Ilya Borisovich Tall grew pensive. It was awkward, most awkward, to dawdle there. Just now there had been an ecstatic surge, a sudden blaze of love between the lonely, elderly Dolinin and the stranger who happened to share his box, a girl in black, whereupon they decided to escape from the theater, far, far away from the décolleté and military uniforms. Somewhere beyond the theater, the author dimly visualized the Kupichevsky or Tsarsky Park. Locusts in bloom. Precipices. A starry night. The author was terribly impatient to plunge with his hero and heroine into that starry night. Still, one had to get one's coats, and that interfered with the glamour. Ilya Borisovich reread what he had written, puffed out his cheeks, stared at the crystal paperweight, and finally made up his mind to sacrifice glamour to realism. This did not prove simple. His leanings were strictly lyrical. Descriptions of nature and emotions came to him with surprising facility, but on the other hand, he had a lot of trouble with routine items, such as, for instance, the opening and closing of doors, or shaking hands when there were numerous characters in a room, and one person or two persons saluted many people. Furthermore, Ilya Borisovich tussled constantly with pronouns, as, for example, she, which had a teasing way of referring not only to the heroine, but also to her mother or sister in the same sentence, so that, in order to avoid repeating a proper name, one was often compelled to put that lady or her interlocutress, although no interlocution was taking place. Writing meant to him an unequal contest with indispensable objects. Luxury goods appeared to be much more compliant, but even they rebelled now and then, got stuck, hampered one's freedom of movement. And now, having ponderously finished with the cloakroom fuss and being about to present his hero with an elegant cane, Ilya Borisovich naively delighted in the gleam of its rich knob, and did not foresee, alas, what claims that valuable article would make, how painfully it would demand mention. When Dolinin, his hands feeling the curves of a supple young body, would be carrying Irina across a vernal rill. Dolinin was simply elderly. Ilya Borisovich Tall would soon be 55. Dolinin was colossally wealthy, without precise explanation of his source of income. Ilya Borisovich directed a company engaged in the installation of bathrooms. That year, incidentally, it had been appointed to panel with enameled tiles the cavernal walls of several underground stations, and was quite well to do. Dolinin lived in Russia, South Russia probably, and first met Irina long before the revolution. Ilya Borisovich lived in Berlin, whither he had migrated with wife and son in 1920. His literary output was of long standing, but not big. The obituary of a local merchant famous for his liberal political views, in the Kharkov Herald, 1910. Two prose poems, Ibid, August 1914 and March 1917, and one book, consisting of that obituary and those two prose poems, a pretty volume that landed right in the raging middle of the Civil War. Finally, upon reaching Berlin, Ilya Borisovich wrote a little étude, Travelers by Sea and Land, which appeared in a humble émigré daily published in Chicago. But that newspaper soon vanished like smoke, while other periodicals did not return manuscripts and never discussed rejections. Then followed 2 years of creative silence, his wife's illness and death, the Inflation site, 1,000 business undertakings. His son finished high school in Berlin and entered Freiburg University, and now, in 1925, at the onset of old age, this prosperous and on the whole very lonely person experienced such an attack of writer's itch, such a longing, oh, not for fame, but simply for some warmth and heed on the part of readerdom, that he resolved to let himself go, write a novel and have it published at his own cost. Already by the time that its protagonist, the heavy-hearted, world-weary Dolinin, hearkened to the clarion of a new life and, after that almost fatal stop at the cloakroom, escorted his young companion into the April night, the novel had acquired a title, Lips to Lips. Dolinin had Irina moved to his flat, but nothing had happened yet in the way of lovemaking, for he desired that she come to his bed of her own accord, exclaiming, "Take me, take my purity, take my torment. Your loneliness is my loneliness, and however long or short your love may be, I am prepared for everything, because around us spring summons us to humanness and good, because the sky and the firmament radiate divine beauty, and because I love you." "A powerful passage," observed Yevpratsky. "Terra firmament, I dare say. Very powerful." "And it is not boring?" asked Ilya Borisovich Tal, glancing over his horn-rimmed glasses. "Eh? Tell me frankly." "I suppose he'll deflower her," mused Yevpratsky. "Mima, Chitatsel, Mima." "Wrong, reader, wrong," answered Ilya Borisovich, misinterpreting Turgenev. He smiled rather smugly, gave his manuscript a resettling shake, crossed his fat thighed legs more comfortably, and continued his reading. He read his novel to Yevpratsky bit by bit, at the rate of production. Yevpratsky, who had once swooped upon him on the occasion of a concert with a charitable purpose, was an émigré journalist, with a name, or rather with a dozen pseudonyms. Hitherto, Ilya Borisovich's acquaintances used to come from German industrial circles. Now he attended émigré meetings, lectures, amateur theatricals, and had learned to recognize some of the belles-lettres brethren. He was on especially good terms with Yevpratsky, and valued his opinion as coming from a stylist, although Yevpratsky's style belonged to the topical sort we all know. Ilya Borisovich frequently invited him. They sipped cognac and talked about Russian literature, or more exactly, Ilya Borisovich did the talking, and the guest avidly collected comical scraps with which to entertain his own cronies later. True, Ilya Borisovich's tastes were on the heavier side. He gave Pushkin his due, of course, but knew him mainly through the medium of 3 or 4 operas, and in general found him Olympically serene and incapable of stirring the reader. His knowledge of more recent poetry was limited to his remembering 2 poems, both with a political slant. The Sea, by Weinberg, 1830 through 1908, and the famous lines of Skitalyets, Stepan Petrov, born 1868, in which dangled on the gallows rhymes with entangled in a revolutionary plot. Did Ilya Borisovich like to make mild fun of the decadents? Yes, he did, but then one must note that he frankly admitted his incomprehension of verse. Per contra, he was fond of discussing Russian fiction. He esteemed Lugovoy, a regional mediocrity of the 1900s, appreciated Korolenko, and considered that Artsebashev debauched young readers. In regard to the novels of modern émigré writers, he would say with the empty-handed Russian gesture of inutility, "Dull, dull," which sent Yevpratsky into a kind of rapturous trance. "An author should be soulful," Ilya Borisovich would reiterate, "and compassionate and responsive and fair. Maybe I'm a flea, a non-entity, but I have my credo. Let at least one word of my writings impregnate a reader's heart. And Eufratsky would fix reptilian eyes upon him, foretasting with agonizing tenderness tomorrow's mimetic report, A's belly laugh, Z's ventriloquistic squeak. At last came the day when the first draft of the novel was finished. To his friend's suggestion that they repair to a café, Ilya Borisovich replied in a mysterious and weighty tone of voice, "Impossible. I'm polishing my phrasing." The polishing consisted of his launching an attack on the too frequently occurring adjective molodaya, young, feminine gender, replacing it here and there by youthful, Yunaya, which he pronounced with a provincial doubling of the consonant as if it were spelled Yunaya. One day later, twilight, café on Kurfürstendamm, settee of red plush, two gentlemen, to a casual eye, businessmen, one respectable-looking, even rather majestic, a non-smoker, with an expression of trust and kindliness on his fleshy face, the other lean, beetle-browed, with a pair of fastidious folds descending from his triangular nostrils to the lowered corners of his mouth, from which protrudes obliquely a cigarette not yet lit. The first man's quiet voice, "I pen the end in one spurt. He dies, yes, he dies." Silence. The red settee is nice and soft. Beyond the picture window, a translucent tram floats by like a bright fish in an aquarium tank. Eufratsky clicked his cigarette lighter, expulsed smoke from his nostrils, and said, "Tell me, Ilya Borisovich, why not have a literary magazine run it as a serial before it comes out in book form? But look, I've no pull with that crowd. They publish always the same people." "Nonsense. I have a little plan. Let me think it over." "I'd be happy," murmured Tal dreamily. A few days later, in I.B. Tal's room at the office, the unfolding of the little plan. "Send your thing," Eufratsky narrowed his eyes and lowered his voice, "to Arion." "Arion? What's that?" said I.B. nervously, patting his manuscript. "Nothing very frightening. It's the name of the best émigré review. You don't know it? Ay, ay, ay. The first number came out this spring. The second is expected in the fall. You should keep up with literature a bit closer, Ilya Borisovich." "But how to contact them? Just mail it?" "That's right. Straight to the editor. It's published in Paris. Now don't tell me you've never heard Galatov's name." Guiltily, Ilya Borisovich shrugged one fat shoulder. Eufratsky, his face working, wryly explained, "A writer, a master, new form of the novel, intricate construction, Galatov, the Russian Joyce." "Joyce," meekly repeated Ilya Borisovich after him. "First of all, have it typed," said Eufratsky, "and for God's sake acquaint yourself with the magazine." He acquainted himself. In one of the Russian bookshops of exile, he was handed a plump pink volume. He bought it, thinking aloud, as it were, "Young venture. Must be encouraged." "Finished, the young venture," said the bookseller. "One number was all that came out." "You are not in touch," rejoined Ilya Borisovich with a smile. "I definitively know that the next number will be out in autumn." Upon coming home, he took an ivory paper knife and neatly cut the magazine's pages. Therein he found an unintelligible piece of prose by Galatov, two or three short stories by vaguely familiar authors, a mist of poems, and an extremely capable article about German industrial problems signed Tigris. "Oh, they'll never accept it," reflected Ilya Borisovich with anguish. "They all belong to one crew." Nevertheless, he located one Madame Lubansky, stenographer and typist, in the advertisement columns of a Russian-language newspaper, and, having summoned her to his apartment, started to dictate with tremendous feeling, boiling with agitation, raising his voice and glancing ever and again at the lady to see her reaction to his novel. Her pencil kept flitting as she bent over her writing pad, a small dark woman with a rash on her forehead. And Ilya Borisovich paced his study in circles, and the circles would tighten around her at the approach of this or that spectacular passage. Toward the end of the first chapter, the room vibrated with his cries. And his entire yore seemed to him a horrible error, roared Ilya Borisovich, and then added in his ordinary office voice, Type this out for tomorrow, 5 copies, wide margins. I shall expect you here at the same hour. That night in bed he kept thinking up what he would tell Galatov when sending the novel. Awaiting your stern judgment, my contributions have appeared in Russia and America. And on the following morning, such is the enchanting obligingness of fate, Ilya Borisovich received this letter from Paris. Dear Boris Grigorovich, I learned from a woman friend that you have completed a new opus. The editorial board of Arion would be interested in seeing it, since we would like to have something refreshing for our next issue. How strange! Only the other day I found myself recalling your elegant miniatures in the Kharkov Herald. I'm remembered. I'm wanted, distractedly uttered Ilya Borisovich. Thereupon he rang up Ufratsky and, throwing himself back in his armchair sideways, with the uncouthness of triumph, leaning the hand that held the receiver upon his desk, while outlining an ample gesture with the other, and beaming all over, he drawled, Well-o, old boy! Well-o, old boy! And suddenly the various bright objects upon the desk began to tremble and twin and dissolve in a moist mirage. He blinked. Everything resumed its right place, and Ufratsky's languid voice replied, Oh, come! Brother writer's ordinary good turn. 5 stacks of typed pages grew higher and higher. Dolinin, who, with one thing and another, had not yet possessed his fair companion, happened to discover that she was infatuated with another man, a young painter. Sometimes I.B. dictated in his office, and then the German typists in the other rooms, hearing that remote roar, wondered who on earth was being bawled out by the usually good-natured boss. Dolinin had a heart-to-heart talk with Irina. She told him she would never leave him, because she prized too highly his beautiful, lonely soul. But alas, she belonged physically to another, and Dolinin silently bowed. At last the day came when he made a will in her favor. The day came when he shot himself with a Mauser pistol. The day came when Ilya Borisovich, smiling blissfully, asked Madame Lubansky, who had brought the final portion of the typescript, how much he owed her, and attempted to overpay. With ravishment he reread Lips to Lips, and handed over one copy to Ufratsky for corrections. Some discreet editing had already been accomplished by Madame Lubansky, at such points where chance omissions garbled her shorthand notes. All Ufratsky did was to insert in one of the first lines a temperamental comma in red pencil. Ilya Borisovich religiously transported that comma to the copy destined for Arion, signed his novel with a pseudonym derived from Anna, the name of his dead wife, fastened every chapter with a trim clip, added a lengthy letter, slipped all this into a huge solid envelope, weighed it, went to the post office himself, and sent the novel by registered mail. With a receipt tucked away in his wallet, Ilya Borisovich braced himself for weeks and weeks of tremulous waiting. Galatov's reply came, however, with miraculous promptness, on the 5th day. Dear Ilya Grigorievich, the editors are more than entranced with the material you sent us. Seldom have we had the occasion to peruse pages upon which a human soul has been so clearly imprinted. Your novel moves the reader with the face's singular expression. To paraphrase Baratinsky, the singer of the Finnish crags, it breathes bitterness and tenderness. Some of the descriptions, such as, for example, that of the theater in the very beginning, compete with analogous images in the works of our classical writers, and in a certain sense gain the ascendancy. This I say with a full awareness of the responsibility attached to such a statement. Your novel would have been a genuine adornment of our review. As soon as Ilya Borisovich had somewhat recovered his composure, he walked over to the Tiergarten, instead of riding to his office, and sat there on a park bench, tracing arcs on the brown ground, thinking of his wife, and imagining how she would have rejoiced with him. After a while he went to see Yevpratsky. The latter lay in bed, smoking. They analyzed together every line of the letter. When they got to the last one, Ilya Borisovich meekly raised his eyes and asked, "Tell me, why do you think he put would have been and not will be? Doesn't he understand that I'm overjoyed to give them my novel? Or is it simply a stylistic device?" "I'm afraid there's another reason," answered Yevpratsky. "No doubt it's a case of concealing something out of sheer pride. In point of fact, the magazine is folding up." "Yes, that's what I've just learned. The émigré public consumes, as you know, all sorts of trash, and Arion is meant for the sophisticated reader. Well, that's the result." "I've also heard rumors," said very much perturbed Ilya Borisovich, "but I thought it was slander spread by competitors, or mere stupidity. Can it be really possible that no second issue will ever come out? It is awful." "They have no funds. The review is a disinterested, idealistic enterprise. Such publications, alas, perish." "But how can it be?" cried Ilya Borisovich with a Russian splash gesture of helpless dismay. "Haven't they approved my thing? Don't they want to print it?" "Yes, too bad," said Yevpratsky calmly. "By the way, tell me," and he changed the subject. That night Ilya Borisovich did some hard thinking, conferred with his inner self, and next morning phoned his friend to submit to him certain questions of a financial nature. Yevpratsky's replies were listless in tone, but most accurate in sense. Ilya Borisovich pondered some more, and on the following day made Yevpratsky an offer to be submitted to Arion. The offer was accepted, and Ilya Borisovich transferred to Paris a certain amount of money. In reply, he got a letter with expressions of deep gratitude and a communication to the effect that the next issue of Arion would come out in a month's time. A postscript contained a courteous request: "Allow us to put a novel by Ilya Anensky, and not, as you suggest, I. Anensky. Otherwise there might be some confusion with the last swan of Tsarska Silwa, as Gumilov calls him." Ilya Borisovich answered, "Yes, of course. I just did not know that there already existed an author writing under that name. I am delighted my work will be printed. Please have the kindness to send me 5 specimens of your journal as soon as it is out." He had in view an old female cousin and 2 or 3 business acquaintances. His son did not read Russian. Here began the era in his life which the wits denoted by the term apropos. Either in a Russian bookshop or at a meeting of the Friends of Expatriate Arts, or else simply on the sidewalk of a West Berlin street, you were amiably accosted, "Ah, how goes it?" by a person you knew slightly, a pleasant and dignified gentleman wearing horn-rimmed glasses and carrying a cane, who would engage you in casual conversation about this and that, would imperceptibly pass from this and that to the subject of literature, and would suddenly say, "Apropos, here's what Galatov writes me." "Yes, Galatov. Galatov, the Russian Joyce." You take the letter and scan it. Editors are more than entranced. Our classical writers. Adornment of our review. "He got my patronymic wrong," adds Ilya Borisovich with a kindly chuckle. "You know how writers are. Absent-minded. The journal will come out in September. You will read my little work." And replacing the letter in his wallet, he takes leave of you, and with a worried air, hurries away. Literary failures, hack journalists, special correspondents of forgotten newspapers derided him with savage volupté. Such hoots are emitted by delinquents torturing a cat. Such a spark glows in the eyes of a no longer young, sexually unlucky fellow telling a particularly dirty story. Naturally, it was behind his back that they jeered, but they did so with the utmost sans-gêne, disregarding the superb acoustics of every locus of tattle. Being, however, as deaf to the world as a grouse in courtship, he probably did not catch one sound of all this. He blossomed. He walked his cane with a new novelistic stance. He started writing to his son in Russian with an interlinear German translation of most of the words. At the office one knew already that I. B. Tall was not only an excellent person, but also a schriftseller, and some of his business friends confided their love secrets to him as themes he might use. To him, sensing a certain warm zephyr, there began to flock in through the front hall or back door the motley mendicancy of emigration. Public figures addressed him with respect. The fact could not be denied. Ilya Borisovich was indeed surrounded by esteem and fame. Not a single party in a cultured Russian milieu passed without his name being mentioned. How it was mentioned, with what kind of snicker, hardly matters. The thing, not the way, is important, says true wisdom. At the end of the month, Ilya Borisovich had to leave town on a tedious business trip, and so he missed the advertisements in Russian-language newspapers regarding the coming publication of Orion II. When he returned to Berlin, a large cubicle package awaited him on the hallway table. Without taking his topcoat off, he instantaneously undid the parcel. Pink, plump, cool tomes. And on the covers, Orion, in purple-red letters. 6 copies. Ilya Borisovich attempted to open one. The book crackled deliciously, but refused to unclose. Blind, newborn. He tried again and caught a glimpse of alien versicles. He swung the mass of uncut pages from right to left and happened to spot the table of contents. His eye raced through names and titles, but he was not there. He was not there. The volume endeavored to shut. He applied force and reached the end of the list. Nothing. How could that be, good God? Impossible. Must have been omitted by chance from the table. Such things happen. They happen. He was now in his study, and seizing his white knife, he stuck it into the thick foliated flesh of the book. First Galatov, of course, then poetry, then two stories, then again poetry, again prose, and farther on, nothing but trivia, surveys, critiques, and so forth. Ilya Borisovich was overwhelmed all at once by a sense of fatigue and futility. Well, nothing to be done. Maybe they had too much material. They'll print it on the next number. Oh, that's for certain. But a new period of waiting. Well, I'll wait. Mechanically, he kept sifting the soft pages between finger and thumb. Fancy paper. Well, I've been at least of some help. One can't insist on being printed instead of Galatov, or... And here, abruptly, there jumped out and whirled and went tripping along, hand on hip, in a Russian dance, the dear, heart-warm words, her youthful, hardly formed bosom. Violins were still weeping. Both little tickets. The spring night welcomed them with a cur... And on the reverse page, as inevitably as the continuation of rails after a tunnel, Essing and passionate breath of wind. How the deuce didn't I guess immediately? Ejaculated Ilya Borisovich. It was entitled Prologue to a Novel. It was signed A. Ilyin, with, in parenthesis, to be continued. A small bit, 3 pages and a half, but what a nice bit! Overture! Elegant! Ilyin is better than Anensky. Might have been a mix-up, even if they had put Ilya Anensky. But why prologue and not simply lips to lips, chapter one? Oh, that's quite unimportant. He reread the piece thrice. Then he laid the magazine aside, paced his study, whistling negligently the while, as if nothing whatever had happened. Well, yes, there's that book lying there, some book or other. Who cares? Whereupon he rushed toward it and reread himself 8 times in a row. Then he looked up. A. Ilyin, page 205, in the table of contents, found page 205, and relishing every word, reread his prologue. He kept playing that way for quite a time. The magazine replaced the letter. Ilya Borisovich constantly carried a copy of Arion under his arm, and upon running into any sort of acquaintance, opened the volume at a page that had grown accustomed to presenting itself. Arion was reviewed in the papers. The first of those reviews did not mention Ilyin at all. The second had. Mr. Ilyin's prologue to a novel must surely be a joke of some kind. The third noted merely that Ilyin and another were newcomers to the magazine. Finally, a fourth reviewer, in a charming, modest little periodical appearing somewhere in Poland, wrote as follows. Ilyin's piece attracts one by its sincerity. The author pictures the birth of love against a background of music. Among the indubitable qualities of the piece, one should mention the good style of the narration. A new era started after the apropos period and the book-carrying one. Ilya Borisovich would extract that review from his wallet. He was happy. He purchased 6 more copies. He was happy. Silence was readily explained by inertia, detraction by enmity. He was happy. To be continued. And then one Sunday came a telephone call from Ufratsky. Guess, he said, who wants to speak to you? Galatov. Yes, he's in Berlin for a couple of days. I passed the receiver. A voice never yet heard took over. A shimmering, urgeful, mellow, narcotic voice. A meeting was settled. Tomorrow at 5 at my place, said Ilya Borisovich. What a pity you can't come tonight. Very regrettable, rejoined the shimmering voice. You see, I'm being dragged by friends to attend the Black Panther. Terrible play. But it's such a long time since I've seen dear Elena Dmitrievna. Elena Dmitrievna Garina, a handsome elderly actress who had arrived from Riga to star in the repertoire of a Russian-language theater in Berlin, beginning at 8:30. After a solitary supper, Ilya Borisovich suddenly glanced at his watch, smiled a sly smile, and took a taxi to the theater. The theater was really a large hall meant for lectures rather than plays. The performance had not yet started. An amateur poster featured Garina reclining on the skin of a panther shot by her lover, who was to shoot her later on. Russian speech crepitated in the cold vestibule. Ilya Borisovich relinquished into the hands of an old woman in black his cane, his bowler, and his topcoat, paid for a numbered jeton, which he slipped into his waistcoat pocket, and leisurely rubbing his hands, looked around the vestibule. Close to him stood a group of 3 people, a young reporter whom Ilya Borisovich knew slightly, the young man's wife, an angular lady with a lorgnette, and a stranger in a flashy suit with a pale complexion, a little black beard, beautiful ovine eyes, and a gold chainlet around his hairy wrist. But why, oh why, the lady was saying to him vivaciously, why did you print it? 'Cause you know... Now stop attacking that unfortunate fellow, replied her interlocutor in an iridescent baritone voice. All right, he's a hopeless mediocrity, I grant you that. But evidently we had reasons. He added something in an undertone, and the lady, with a click of her lorgnette, retorted in anger, excuse me. But in my opinion, if you print him only because he supports you financially... Doucement, doucement, Don't proclaim our editorial secrets. Here Ilya Borisovich caught the eye of the young reporter, the angular lady's husband, and the latter froze for an instant and then moaned with a start and proceeded to push his wife away with his whole body. But she continued to speak at the top of her voice. I'm not concerned with the wretched Ilyin. I'm concerned with matters of principle. Sometimes principles have to be sacrificed, coolly said the opal-voiced fop. But Ilya Borisovich was no longer listening. He saw things through a haze, and being in a state of utter distress, not yet realizing fully the horror of the event, but instinctively striving to retreat as fast as possible from something shameful, odious, intolerable, he moved at first toward the vague spot where vague seats were being sold, but then abruptly turned back, almost collided with Eufratsky, who was hurrying toward him, and made for the cloakroom. Old woman in black, number 79, down there. He was in a desperate hurry, had already swept his arm back to get into a last coat sleeve, but here Eufratsky caught up with him, accompanied by the other... Mira Raditer, said Eufratsky, while Galatov, rolling his eyes and trying not to let Ilya Borisovich regain his wits, kept catching the sleeve in a semblance of assistance and talking fast. Inokienti, Borisovich, how are you? Very glad to make your acquaintance. Pleasant occasion. Allow me to help you. For God's sake, leave me alone, muttered Ilya Borisovich, struggling with the coat and with Galatov. Go away. Disgusting. I can't... It's disgusting. Obvious misunderstanding, put in Galatov at top speed. Leave me alone, cried Ilya Borisovich, wrenched himself free, scooped up his bowler from the counter and went out, still putting on his coat. He kept whispering incoherently as he marched along the sidewalk. Then he spread his hands. He had forgotten his cane. Automatically, he continued to walk, but presently, with a quiet little stumble, came to a stop, as if the clockwork had run out. He would go back for the thing once the performance had started. Must wait a few minutes. Cars sped by. Tram cars rang their bells. The night was clear, dry, spruced up with lights. He began to walk slowly toward the theater. He reflected that he was old, lonely, that his joys were few, and that old people must pay for their joys. He reflected that perhaps, even tonight, and in any case tomorrow, Galatov would come with explanations, exhortations, justifications. He knew that he must forgive everything, otherwise the to be continued would never materialize. And he also told himself that he would be fully recognized after his death. And he recollected, he gathered up in a tiny heap all the crumbs of praise he had received lately, and slowly walked to and fro, and after a while went back for his cane.